When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hej och välkomna till Vinpratarna. Det är säsongsavslut idag och ni ska få höra på en intervju med Peter Logan från producenten med samma namn som kommer från Orange, vilket ligger strax nordväst om Sydney i Australien. Logan är en av de här nya spännande ambassadörerna för svalodlade, rena och pigga australiska viner. Och vi fick ett snack med honom nu när han var på Sverigebesök för några veckor sedan. Men det vill vi också tacka för den gångna säsongen. Det har varit jätteroligt. Tack för att ni lyssnar. Och nu blir det lite sommarlov och så hörs vi såklart igen i höst. Men fortsätt gärna höra av er med frågor och tips och tagga oss på Insta när ni dricker något gott och så. Jag tycker det är superkul att hålla kontakt och vi svarar på allt som alla mejl vi får och så fort vi kan. Så tills vi hörs igen så får vi önska en jätteglad sommar och ha trevlig lyssning. Ha det gott! Welcome to Sweden and welcome to this podcast that we're called Vinpratarna.
Thank you.
I heard you started off actually as a musician way back in the days.
Well, a bad musician. I was a bass player in a band and I found my art in a different way, and the rest of the band I think were pretty relieved when I said moving out to the countryside to make wine, I'm going to have to leave. They went, oh, really? Okay, bye. And then they went on to record about 15 albums.
okay. So they didn't try to convince you?
No.
So, okay.
No.
But what happened then? Because you started working in... you studied chemistry and biology and stuff like that.
Yes, right? Yes, I did. And I was working as a... I really wanted to be a park ranger when I left uni, but that didn't happen, and ended up falling into, sort of by accident, because I'd studied chemistry, being a chemist for a pharmaceutical company, and was doing that for a while, and then woke up one day and went, what am I doing? went to just threw in my job and did a vintage on a winery just to kill time to work out what I was going to do, and loved it.
Yeah.
And never looked back. And then did a postgraduate diploma in winemaking because it's a science degree and I already had the science degree, so you can just do the one-year postgraduate diploma. And then luckily I had a very entrepreneurial accountant for a dad. So while I was working for other people, he was antagonizing, saying, come on, let's just start our own thing. So so I did that while I was working for other people. And then I thought I'd give it a go while I was young enough to fail and then move on to something else. But 22 years later, I'm still going.
Yeah, you started in 97 was your first vintage.
Yeah.
That's very, but when you grew up, I mean, your parents, were they into wine? I mean, wine nerds, interested?
Not wine nerds. They weren't cork dorts, but loved wine and drank wine every day. Like, my dad drank sparkling or Chardonnay every day. He only drank sparkling or Chardonnay.
Huh?
So he's a real champagne Jane, and loves Chardonnay, but and really didn't drink any other wine, but he drank them every day.
Yeah.
And loved them, and didn't drink beer, really. It was just those.
Okay.
Yeah.
No Fosters.
And so through them, I got an appreciation for those styles of wine. And then, you know, I was more adventurous than my dad in taste, so moved out into everything else. But really backpacking around the world was where I really got a taste for wine. And looking back, you know, I was backpacking. I didn't have any money. I was in my early 20s and I was drinking bad carafe wine with floaties in it and stuff.
Yeah.
But time and place and everything, it just worked. And that sort of started my the romance side of wine kicked in there.
But also tell us, because you have around a little bit over 100 hectares, 106 or something like that,
yeah,
right?
Yep.
And mainly in Orange and Mudgee.
All in Mudgee.
Yeah. And can you tell us about these regions, I mean, when it comes to soil and climate and altitude and all that?
Yeah, definitely. So they're both high altitude places. They're both they're west of Sydney, 300 kilometres west of Sydney, if you can picture where that is. Mm-hmm. But they're up in the mountains. They're in the mountain range called the Great Dividing Range in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And Mudgee, we're at 560 metres above sea level. Mm. And there you get very cold nights, but still reasonably warm days.
Mm.
And then up in Orange, we're up at 1,000 metres above sea level.
All right.
And up there at 1,000 metres, you get only cool to mild days and cold nights.
Yeah.
But the other two very important parts of the terroir of those two regions is that the sun, it's very sunny. They're both very sunny because there's another mountain range between them and the sea.
Mm.
And so all the weather comes from the west. And the west is, if you can imagine a big picture of Australia, it's mostly desert. That's where the weather's coming from, the desert. And so it's dry air that's coming across the desert, then gets pushed up into the mountains and cools.
Okay.
So we don't really have cloudy days. We have days where it rains, of course, but there's not that many of them in a year. And if it's not raining, it's blue skies.
All right.
So you're cool but sunny. So you ripen slowly but ripen nice and fully. And then the
sort of perfect.
Yeah. That sounds ideal, doesn't it? And then the third part of the terroir puzzle is, of course, the soil.
Mm.
And it's different at the two places. Up at the 560 metre level, it's very gravelly ironstone and quartz, red loam gravel.
Mm.
And that gives you quite, in the red wines, quite firm gravelly tannins. Whereas up at 1,000 metres, the reason the Orange region is so high there at 1,000 metres is because it's on Mount Conobolus, which is an extinct volcano. So it's an extinct a while ago. So it's ancient decomposed volcanic soil.
Mm.
And that gives its own character, and particularly you notice it once again more in the reds, in the tannin structures. You're getting a much more sort of velvety.
Uh-huh. Okay. I think people in Sweden are, the general wine drinker are most common with your Pinot Noir.
Yes.
And that is from Orange, right?
We grow that up at 1,000 metres.
Yeah.
So very cold climate Pinot. And up there it's, you get quite a delicate Pinot.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite light bodied. But it still has structure to it. It's not watery and wishy-washy, but light-bodied with structure, and very perfumed.
Mm.
The cold up there with the slow ripening, you get a lot of cherry and like wild strawberry or bush strawberry, we call them, the tiny little ones.
Yeah.
And also a lot of spices like the cinnamon and allspice and those sort of characters.
Yeah, it still has a nice backbone. We're going to try some wines later on.
Yeah.
But also, what grapes do you grow where, so to speak? What do you grow in Orange and what do you grow in Mudgee?
So I put it in Orange at 1,000 metres.
Yeah.
So that's basically the easy way to think about it is that if you're above 600 metres, it's called Orange, and if you're below 600 metres, it's called Mudgee.
Okay.
It's a slight simplification, but it's the easiest way to think of it. Up at Orange, where we're all up at around 1,000 metres, we grow cooler climate varieties generally, but also some of the ones that get thought of as warm climate varieties, just in a different style. So Shiraz, for instance, will grow in both. We actually have a range called Ridge of Tears, which we don't have here at the moment, where it's my top Shiraz, and it's a Shiraz from each region, just showing the terroir difference between the two. So in Mudgee, we grow Tempranillo is really well suited there because Tempranillo likes this big diurnal temperature range we have there in Mudgee and these gravelly ironstone-based soils with a bit of warmth in the day. It'd be too cold up in Orange for it. Most of the other ones we have, Merlot we grow in both. Semillon, for instance, will grow in Mudgee but not Orange because it's too cold up in Orange for it.
Yeah.
But then you've got the cool climate heroes that we have of things like...
Cool climate heroes, I like that.
Riesling and Pinot Gris and Gewurztraminer and Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc and Pinot Noir and things like that.
So you have a lot of different grapes, they're all
up the top of the hill in Orange. But then there's also the Shiraz, but in a much more elegant, pretty, spicy and red-fruited style than it is lower down the hill. And the Bordeaux varieties, we actually grow up higher, not quite at 1,000 metres, at about 850, Cab Sav, Merlot and Cabernet Franc.
Okay.
And they're very good in that area there, but they have a decidedly dry herb edge to them, which is part of their character, like a real tobacco and rosemary edge to them, in with the chocolates and the black fruits and that.
Yeah, cool. Should we try some stuff here? Could you tell me a little bit? Should we start with the Chardonnay?
Yeah.
And it's from Orange.
So this is from Orange. Mm-hmm. While there is, Mudgee's actually the home of Chardonnay in Australia. It was the first place where Chardonnay was grown in Australia for 40 years before it was grown anywhere else. But they didn't know it was Chardonnay then. They were calling it White Pinot, P-I-N-E-A-U. And it was only when someone who had worked in Burgundy went and looked at this vineyard and went, hang on, this is Chardonnay, that they realised what they had. And that was 1970. And then Chardonnay, then the cuttings from that took off all over Australia and the Chardonnay boom happened.
Oh, wow.
But for 40 years, this one vineyard in Mudgee was the only one that had it. Anyway, I prefer it up really high, up at the high altitude up in Orange, where you got real true cool climate, cold climate even up there, but lots of sun, so you still get ripeness, as I said. And so you can see, for me, barrel fermentation is important in Chardonnay because, as one of my Australian winemaking friends, Luke Lambert, said, magic happens in oak, and it's true.
Yeah.
But you don't want to, you don't see that magic if all you see is the oak.
No, exactly.
So I use large oak barrels and a lot of different ages and, you know, not much new oak so that you get the complexity of the barrel fermentation, but you're seeing the fruit characters and the secondary lazy characters and those sort of things. As with everything, it's wild yeast ferment, as with all the wines, which just helps the texture, I think. You can probably describe it better than I, but it's really based around the lemon and the light stone fruit and nut characters that we get there.
A bit of orange as well. I mean, a little bit of orange zest almost.
It's interesting you say that. People sort of think that it's word association when they go, I think I actually taste orange in this, but it is over the years, it is a dominant character in orange Chardonnay, but even in a lot of other varieties, but particularly in Chardonnay, is this orange character.
Yeah.
Orange from orange.
Yeah, yeah. That's quite interesting. And the wood feeling is just very elegant. I mean, you sense it, and it brings a little bit of spiciness.
That's right, yeah. Which we don't want you to be drinking an ashtray.
that's good. But do you have a sort of a general winemaking philosophy at Logan, or is it?
Yes, we do.
Could you describe that?
Yeah, and that is basically, I think there's so many great wines made in the world that you have to take the drinker on a journey to where your wine has come from. And we're in this very unique terroir, high altitude, but lots of sun and volcanic soil up in Orange. That's a unique terroir. So what I want to do is express that. I want to take people on a journey there. So that's why I'm not letting the oak get in the way while it's expressing itself best after it's been in oak. It's trying to, in a pretty way, because I like to make pretty and elegant wines, and that's why I went to orange in the first place. So our house style is pretty elegant wines that really show the terroir of the region.
Yeah, this is beautiful.
Thank you.
Also, sort of a mineralic kick.
Yes.
in the finish.
Yep, definitely. Once again, that's a classic thing that you get in orange because it's so cold up there, but if you do much malolactic fermentation, then you lose that. So we don't do that.
And then we have
a Pinot Gris.
Pinot Gris, yeah.
It's a very interesting Pinot Gris.
It's an interesting grape.
It is.
Have you worked with that from the beginning?
Not from the beginning, but for quite a while. Mm-hmm. So since 2005 was our first harvest of Alpino Gris.
Oh, okay.
So it's now 13 years. And Pinot Gris, it can be a great variety or it can be a very boring variety, depending on how you make it. If you just grow it anywhere, pick it, crush it, ferment it and put it out, it's alcohol delivery device, essentially. It doesn't have much flavour. And some people like that. They don't want a complicated wine. They just want an alcohol delivery device. However, it's almost identical genetically to Pinot Noir. There's only one allele difference between Pinot Gris and Pinot Noir. And you never make Pinot Noir that way. You put a lot of effort into your Pinot Noir. Mm. So we like to put a lot of effort into our Pinot Gris as well. So first thing you'll notice when I pour it is the colour.
The colour, yeah. It's amazing, sort of pinkish orange.
Like a cross between rust and apricot and salmon.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and so basically I make this wine in four parcels. One parcel I pick early at like what would be a Pinot Grigio style, and that's to keep some nice structure in the wine. Because by the time you get the good flavours in the Pinot Gris, you don't have much acid left in the grapes. But so I do one harvest early so that you keep the acid structure. Then when you get the nice rich pear character in the grapes, I go through and pick the rest of the grapes and divide that into three parcels. One parcel is fermented in stainless steel to retain that lovely pear fruit character.
Yeah.
One parcel is fermented in oak barrels to build the mid-palate texture and enhance the nut and like nougat elements. But then very importantly, the third part of that harvest is fermented on its skins as if it were a red wine. And when you do that, you get a lot of those complex aromas. Once again, orange is a character. I think orange rind, but also a lot of florals and spices.
Yeah. A little bit Pinot Noir-esque
nose. Yes, it is.
I mean, with the almost red fruits.
That's right.
Well,
and I make that parcel. We make it like we're making Pinot Noir. We just put it into a little open fermenter and plunge it by hand.
Yeah.
Just like we would with Pinot Noir. And then what that parcel also does is, of course, it contributes the colour. But it also, very importantly, gives a crunchy finish because of the tannins that you get from fermenting that way on the skins. You get like a nice, clean, crunchy tang to the back of the palate, which cleans the palate out and gives a length to it and means it goes great with food.
And yeah. Because on this, you have a, it says Wimala.
Wimala. So Wimala. Wimala is the name of my farm.
Oh.
Well, one of my farms. And it's an Aboriginal word, Australian native Aboriginal word that means beautiful view. And we do, if you come out and visit us, we do have a very beautiful view at the Cellar Door.
Yeah.
And they've all got different little bird on the label because we have a lot of native birds that fly around our vineyard.
Yeah.
So we put them on the label. This one on the Pinot Gris label, actually I don't like very much this bird because it likes to go up to particularly the Pinot Gris grapes and stick its beak in one and then move to the next bunch and do it again.
Okay, but it's a nice...
but it's a lovely bird.
Yeah, it's a lovely bird and a nice label
It is a lovely
well.
Bird, but it's a bit cheeky.
Oh, this Pinot Gris is, wow, food-friendly wine. Indeed.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, particularly with like, yeah, a lot of your fish that you have over here, I'd say, work very well, particularly with some citrus in the sauce.
Oh, perfect, perfect. But also some melted butter. I mean,
yeah,
it's
yeah, definitely.
Quite fat.
Yeah, exactly.
Beautiful. I love that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Would you like to have a look at some Pinot Noir?
Yeah, sure, sure. And this is the Pinot Noir we had in the small party system.
Correct. Yes.
For a couple of times, I
twice
think.
Twice it's been
twice,
in, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, let's hope for number three.
Yeah, I love the color on this one. It's so... especially if you're I mean to be a new world Pinot Noir, so to speak. This is really, really elegant, very transparent. You can see it at its high altitude.
That's right. Well, there is a number of new world Pinot Noirs, particularly from my Kiwi neighbours, but also from Australia, who it's almost like mini Shiraz. They're so extracted and so big. And for me, that's not Pinot Noir. They can be lovely wines, but they're just not all that Pinot Noir-y. So I like to be very delicate in the winery with it, and we just plunge this very gently by hand. And that means you release... If it's too extracted, a lot of the beautiful, gentle texture and perfume is hidden.
Yeah.
And that's really what... For me, that's what Pinot Noir is about.
Yeah.
So that's what we really try to exhibit.
How do you work when it comes to oak on this one?
So this is about not all of it. A part of it goes into oak barrels.
Large old barrels.
The new barrels, just because it's so delicate, they're just annihilate it.
Yeah.
We try it every year, put one a bit into one barrel and go, that didn't work. So we keep our new barrels for things like Tempranillo and Cabernet Sauvignon and stuff that can handle the new oak.
Exactly.
And then they move to Pinot Noir afterwards.
But how much, when it comes to grapes, I mean, what grape do you have most of? Or is it...
Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris, actually. Yeah.
And how much of each?
It comes to, there's multiple blocks of each, but it basically comes to about 10, 15 hectares, 15 to 20 hectares of each.
Okay. Well, I don't know if it's, I mean, on this one, I felt it before because I know the volcanic soil, but it almost feels like, I don't know if it's just imagination, but a little bit of smoky minerality in the end.
No, that's right. I definitely see that. And that's not from the oak because, I said, they're old barrels and there's and only part of it's been into the oak at all. No. It's just that is the terroir of the Pinot Noir in our area. You do get like a smoky, earthy sort of roasted thyme.
Exactly.
Sort of character to it.
And I think, how many bottles of this do you do? I think we got 4,800 or something like that in Sweden the last time, which was a couple of months ago. But how many bottles a year do you do?
This one, this and the Pinot Gris are our biggest. So it's 60,000.
Yeah, okay. And I'm going to try some things that I've never tried. I'm going to try Tempranillo and Shiraz and Cabernet Merlot. It's going to be really exciting.
Have you tried a Tempranillo from Australia before?
Yeah, I have. I don't remember. I don't remember what
produce from McLaren Vale or Barossa. There's a few down there.
Yeah, I've tried something from Yara.
Okay.
I don't remember the producer, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a variety that's starting to be planted a bit in Australia. And we planted it at our Mudgee vineyard. Actually, we planted it at the same time as 8 others. Everyone in the Mudgee region is a small family company. There's no multinational companies. And so you can just do things because it's your own decision.
Yeah.
And so a few years back, one of the guys in town, winemakers, it's a very good community, the winemaking community there. They're very fostering and helping and we have a soccer team, an indoor soccer team together, just the winemakers.
Yeah, all right.
One of the guys said a few years ago, let's all get together and have a drink next Thursday and everyone bring a bottle of red that you think would work in our region.
Yeah.
And there's manner of things, but we all kept coming back to the Tempranillo because soil-wise, climate-wise, it seemed like it would work. You could make lovely medium-bodied, rustic red, which was the sort of thing we're all interested in. Mm. And so, 8 of us went out that year and planted Tempranillo so that the region could get a bit of a name for it. And now that was our first vintage was the 2012. Now this is the 2016.
16. Okay.
So, what we're going for, you know, it's not Rioja. No. Rioja's great, but Rioja's Rioja. Ribera del Duero is the same. Same with, up at in Portugal and up at Priorat and La Mancha.
Less oak in this one, for sure.
Less oak, definitely. So while, once again, all of this has been into oak, only part of it's new oak, but a lot of it's old oak, because I want to show the varietal and regional characters of Tempranillo. If I just smashed it with oak, it may look, for the Rioja fans, it may look a bit like Rioja, but what's the point? Rioja does Rioja. So I think you get the real, what I see is the regional varietal characters here is that real sort of like cherry cola without the sugar, like a sarsaparilla-y type character and a bit of a cherry character.
Quite a lot of cherry I get.
Yeah. And even a little vanilla, which doesn't come from the oak. We notice the vanilla in the wine before we even put it in oak. So it's a rare variety that has a vanilla character on its own. And then you notice the palate is, it's not polished, it's quite rustically structured. Only medium bodied, but quite a lot in the medium body.
Yeah. And quite, I mean, the tannins are definitely obvious, but well integrated. But how long do you think a wine like this would keep in the cellar?
Quite a long time. So those tannins that you just pointed to, they're really good for aging. People have known for years that Mudgy Reds age for a long time. But the Australian Wine Research Institute just recently did a study of tannins and across regions and pinpointed the type of tannin that you get in Mudgy Reds as the ones that do most of the work in the cellar over the years.
Okay.
So that will age for a good, well, look, it'll age fine for a good 20 years. But what you have to keep in mind is that cherry fruit is so important to the wine. So you want it while it's still there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think at 10 years old, it's going to be looking absolutely beautiful. But, you know, it'll age for a lot longer.
Yeah. I also noticed that you work with screw cap. Do you have that on all your wines?
All apart from the sparkling.
Of course, yeah.
But, yeah, so the reason I use screw cap is because corks can just have too many problems. Whether it's cork taint that that makes the wines smell like old wet socks, or whether it's variable oxygen that passes through from one cork to the next to makes them age at completely different rates. You know, I planted the wines in this very individual terroir, go out in the middle of winter to prune the vines at exactly the right time, do everything to grow them perfectly, pick them at the right time, everything in the winery to make the best wine, then I don't understand why, when it comes to bottling, why you would then play Russian roulette with what you put in the top. Whereas with screw cap, all wines, you don't get any of the taints, and all wines in screw cap age at the same rate. So there's still oxygen passing through the screw cap, but the same amount from one screw cap to the next.
Yes.
So after 15 years, if you had this Tempranillo and you had it in cork and you pulled out a bottle at a dinner party in 15 years' time, everyone went, that's fantastic, let's open another one.
Yeah.
If it was under cork, the one bottle right next to it would be completely different.
Yes.
Whereas if it's in screw cap, it'll be exactly the same.
And you also have had a time to see what happens in like 22 years.
That's right. And
you feel like
the wine's aged
works.
Great.
Yeah. Okay, cool. That's nice. Do you work organically or biodynamically or something like that?
We use what's called integrated pest management.
Yeah.
And integrated weed management, which is basically where you're mostly organic principles, but with a few that aren't organic in order to essentially have the lowest impact on the land.
Exactly.
Completely organic can be great if you're in the right place, but there's very few of those places around. So if it does rain at the wrong time, people don't understand that organic vineyards spray and they spray copper and sulfur out.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you're, what we do basically means that you can just do less spraying overall. And that's what we do. Biodynamic, I agree that the moon definitely influences the ripening of the grapes, but I don't agree with some other parts of it, as in, not, I don't disagree, I just don't feel other parts. More religious side of them I don't feel. So I think it would be a con to just go and say, oh, these are biodynamically farmed if I'm not 100% behind it.
Yeah.
But the moon definitely does influence the ripening, that's for sure.
Yeah, cool. Should we pour some Shiraz now?
Yes, let's.
It is sort of a family business, right? It's you and your wife and...
It started with me and my father.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like I said earlier, he wasn't a winemaker. He was much more important. He was an accountant. So he made sure we didn't go bust while I was working out how to do this. But he passed away in 2004. My wife at the time and I took it over.
Yeah.
We were running it anyway.
Yeah.
but now she's moved out of the business, and so now it's me with a team of 12 staff.
Okay. So Shiraz 2013 from Orange.
Yes. So Shiraz, Australia's national variety, and a lot of people straight away think they know what Australian Shiraz is.
Mm.
And they're right, because what they've seen is what they're thinking of, which is huge, big, blockbuster, oaky, things you can stand your spoon up in. But that's not what I wanted to make. I don't have a problem with those wines, but I don't want to make them. When I planted Shiraz in Orange all those years ago, everyone said you can't grow Shiraz in Orange, but they were meaning that you can't make that style of Shiraz in Orange. There's so much sun there, you can ripen it really well. And look at the Northern Rhone. It's a cool climate variety. It can be a cool climate variety. And so that's the sort of what I wanted to make, was this pretty side of Shiraz. It's still got depth. It's got plenty of depth.
Quite well firm and well structured. Yeah. I mean, that's...
That's right. But the perfume is of sort of spices and red fruits and charcuterie a bit, beefy.
Especially compared to Northern Rhone, I would be like in Saint-Joseph, I think.
I always think Saint-Joseph too. But the volcanic soils give that quite the tannins are there, but they're quite velvety. It's quite mouth-filling. It's a variety I love up in Orange. And now there's quite a lot of Shiraz up in Orange. But when we planted it, it was the first.
Lovely, I think. It drinks so well. I mean, it's only 5 years old, but it's so really good. I think it could hold up for a long time as well. But
that's the difference really between Maggi and Orange Shiraz.
Yeah, but
you can enjoy the Orange ones sort of hit their drinking window earlier than the Maggi ones.
But how does Maggi Shiraz from the same year? What's the difference between
Maggi and Orange? At the moment, it also looks great, but Maggi Shiraz from the same year, you need to either decant it or have it with some protein to really
But the taste profile in general, is it more firm, more tannic?
Much more earth.
Yeah, okay.
And dark chocolate and tobacco and...
more dark berries than the red fruits. Berries. Yeah.
Dark berries, plums. Mm. But Maggi always has a little floral lift to it.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Sort of, must be the cold nights, I think. Because strangely, the nights are colder in Orange, further down in Maggi, than they are in Orange. So at 550 metres, the nights are colder than up at 1,000. And I think that's because the cold air runs down the hill.
Wow. I see I have a paper here that says 199 krones. I think that's for restaurant, but it's still quite affordable. I mean, it's a good, nice price level. It would be like 250 for a consumer.
Yeah. It's one of my pet loves and projects is Shiraz because like I said, when we started there, everyone said you can't do it, showing that we can and have really changed a lot of people's perception of what Australian Shiraz is.
Yeah. Great. And then we have one left then. Cabernet Merlot. And how the blend, I mean, how is it 50-50 or is it...
It's actually Cabernet Franc as well.
Do you do a varietal
Cabernet Franc? I'm hoping to put one out soon.
Cool.
We've been struggling with it for years in that I keep wanting to, and like my Sydney distributor, who's the biggest market, and my wife at the time would always say, no, we can't sell straight Cab Franc. But it's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
But now things are changing in Australia and you can and around the world, and I'm a big fan of it. So good where we are. But now we have this range, which isn't here at the moment, called Clementine, which is for the more interesting esoteric little lines we have. And I'm sure I'm going to be able to work it into that range.
I'd love to try it when it's out.
Thank you. So this one is the Cabernet Sauvignon and the Merlot are pretty well equal in component.
Mm, this is 2012.
And it's 14% of its Cabernet Franc, but when you smell it, it smells like it's all Cabernet Franc.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to say.
It's very Cabernet. Yeah. Only 14%, 1/4.
It really cuts through.
Yeah. And then, but it's, and the balance is, yeah, basically equal between Cab Sav and Merlot.
Mm, okay.
And the Cab Sav up in Orange is a wonderful variety, but it's uncompromising, and it's very hard to have a straight Cab Sav because it's very linear, straight down the middle of the palate. It's got lovely raspberry and tobacco characters and rosemary, but the tannin and acid straight across the middle of the palate is a bit uncomfortable.
A bit harsh.
Yeah. Mm. Merlot is really fills it out beautifully. Merlot's really good up there. Really, it's not light and fluffy. It's dark and black fruits and chocolate, or blue fruits and chocolate and violets and black olive and truffle and stuff. But texturally fills out the Cab Sav. And then the Cab Franc just comes in with the prettiness and the lift and
sort of the Cab Franc perfume.
Yeah, exactly.
Very interesting because it's so much Cab Franc in on the nose, but then in the mouth you feel more of the Cab Sauv, I think.
With Cab Sauv. Definitely. With the structure of the Cab Sauv.
Sort of licorice and cassis.
And the drive that goes straight across the palate.
Yeah, really nice. But how is, when it comes to vintages, since it's quite consistent climate, so you say, or is it big differences from
while I say, you know, it's we don't have a lot of cloudy days, we do have big differences year to year in temperature. So while you do get different amounts of rain too, but the biggest difference is the temperature differences. And particularly in a cold climate, they're amplified because you're out so much longer. So like 2012, this what we're trying here, this was the 11 and 12 were the two coldest vintages we've had. So, we didn't harvest these grapes till middle of May, which if you move that over to add 6 months to what you'd be doing in Europe,
that's June, July, August, October, November.
November, middle of November.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Whereas this year, 2018, which was quite a warm year, we were all finished by the end of March.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So the differences can be quite just based on what the average temperature
September
is.
In Europe.
Yeah. Well, March. Yeah, September. Yeah.
Wow.
So the average temperature over the growing season will change things a lot. Not as much in Mudgee, where it's lower down it's not as amplified. But in Orange, where it's right high up and the growing slow, it's in a cold year, it's even slower. And cool. It gets amplified.
But if you're just going to say something about what's going on in Australia in general, since you're in the winemaking business, do you feel there's any specific trends or movements when it comes to wine in Australia right now?
Oh, yeah, there certainly is. A lot of exploration of minor varieties or varieties that hadn't been really planted much in Australia or at all in Australia in the past. Things like Fiano and Greco and Vermentino and Picpoul and Grüneveltliner and Blaufränkisch. These sort of varieties, there's been quite an exploration of those. As you saw with the Tempranillo here too. That's one. Another one is there's quite a lot of whites being fermented on skins.
Oh yeah.
Either as, for want of a better word, natural orange wines, or just as making them like a red wine. And the great lovely textures and extra flavours you can get out of that. So they're probably the two biggest movements, but probably for the world, what looks like a movement but really isn't, it's more just us showing the world now, is the letting the world know that we're a whole continent and there's a lot of different types of wines made within a continent. And trying to get away from just showing the big Shiraz as this is what Australia is, and the low price sweet things as this is what Australia is, showing that there's 3,000 wineries in Australia, four or five of them are large, 15 of them are medium sized, and then the other 2,980 are small family businesses we are.
Yeah.
And those 2,980 small businesses are all there. Most of them are trying to express their terroir, whether it's a warm climate on sandy soil, whether it's a cold climate on volcanic soil. It doesn't matter. As long as they're representing their place well and showing, making beautiful wines that take you on a journey to that place, then that's what the complex, where the great wines of Australia are. And I think we're starting to get that message out finally.
Yeah. And one last question then, what's cooking at Logan right now? What will happen for you in the sort of upcoming 5 years or so?
Well, I've got another new wine we're releasing this year, which is in the Clementine range I mentioned, which is where we've got Clementine's my daughter's name, and started with bottling some of the Pinot Gris that's the skin fermented just on its own. So very skin fermented Pinot Gris. And that was very popular. So we've added to it a one called Blushing Mini, which is a juicy young red that's made from Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris and Pinot Meunier, which is sort of drunk with a little chill on it.
Too. Oh, okay.
And that's also done well. So now we're completing that range this year with a white. So there'll be a white, an orange and a red.
Okay,
and that's
cool.
It's called the Clementine de la Mer because it's a very salty wine, and it's a blend of skin fermented, well, all skin fermented Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, and Riesling.
Okay,
and
cool.
Very cloudy skin fermented wine, and that's looking lovely. So that's the next thing, is launching that.
Yeah, and then the Cabernet Franc.
And then the Cabernet Franc will come after it. That's right.
Perfect. Well, Peter Logan, thank you for taking the time talking to us, and good luck with everything, and have a nice rest of your stay in Sweden and in Europe.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah. It's been lovely. Thanks for asking me.
Yeah, thank you. Cheers.
Cheers.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.